We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name's David Inge and we're glad to have you with us. When faced with a potential environmental threat, there are some people who would say, well, let's wait until we are certain that there is a threat and then we can take action. Now, there are other people who would argue that that's not the right way to approach environmental problems. They would say our first priority should be protecting public health, and that if we think there is a threat, we ought to act on it, even if our scientific understanding of the threat is incomplete. This is something that has become known as the precautionary principle, and it's a central theme of environmental policy in many countries around the world, but not by and large here in the United States. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about that, about environmental policy, and a little bit about environmental law. All of these things open to conversation this morning, and questions, comments certainly are welcome from listeners. Our guest, Carolyn Raffensperger, is Executive Director of the Science and Environmental Health Network. It's based in Ames, Iowa. She is an attorney by her training and has worked and continues to work in the area of environmental law, specializing in the changes in law and policy necessary for the protection of public health and the environment. She's here visiting in Champaign-Urbana to be the featured speaker at the annual dinner of the Prairie Rivers Network, and that's taking place tonight. Our guest has been involved in environmental work for quite a while, and she does indeed have some history in the state of Illinois. She served as director of the Illinois chapter of the Sierra Club, and was also president of the board of directors of the Illinois Environmental Council. And we're pleased to have her here with us this morning. And certainly, if you're interested in finding out more about the Science and Environmental Health Network, they have a website. There's lots of information there, so you can go there. As long as you have internet access, you can go there and you can see what it's all about. And questions here are welcome to 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So if it would be a long-distance call, use that number. We'll pay for the call. And if you're here locally, use the first number. We just ask people to be brief in their comments just so we can keep moving along. But anybody's welcome to call. Thanks very much for being here.
My pleasure.
To start, I think it would be good to talk a little bit more about the precautionary principle, and particularly because I think here in the way, generally speaking, the way we make policy and we think about environment here in this country, we generally use the risk assessment model, the one that says, well, before we take action, we better know that there is a problem. What is the problem? So we have to do a lot of studies and gather information. And then once we're absolutely sure, or as sure as we can be, okay, then we'll take action. What's wrong? I think you would say, well, there's a better way to do it. What's wrong with that approach?
I'm going to start out with why we did that in the first place.
Okay.
And it's not just risk assessment that we use to make our decisions environmentally. We also use something called cost-benefit analysis. And the reason that we've made decisions and we've waited for scientific certainty before we take action to prevent any kind of harm. So most people would know things about carcinogens. You know, we don't want carcinogens in our food. We don't want carcinogens in our air or water. But we want to make sure that they're carcinogens and that they're going to cause a problem before we actually limit them. The reason that we do that is because we wanted to protect the economy. And we understood that using essentially a utilitarian idea that the greatest good for the greatest number could be measured by dollars. And so we didn't want to limit some kind of economic activity in the world if we were unsure. But what we've discovered is we've made a lot of mistakes. And now we have filled our world with pollutants. We've filled our worlds with technologies that have had consequences that have come back and bitten us. And what we discovered was waiting until we were sure, using tools like epidemiology, where it's very, very difficult to prove that this chemical will cause your cancer. If you were exposed at, say, 8, and your cancer manifests itself when you're 43, it's hard to prove that kind of cause and effect. So the two issues were, one, the economic problems of limiting economic activity in the face of uncertainty, and then the difficulty of proving things, led us to understand that the system was flawed. And we decided that there had to be a better way to make decisions. So we came up with this idea of the precautionary principle, and essentially it was born as an idea in Germany, where private landowners noticed that their forests were dying. And they said to the government, you need to stop this. And we don't know exactly what's causing the death of the forests. It turned out it was power plants, and acid rain was killing forests in Germany. And they adopted something that literally translates into for caring, caring for what might be a difficult future. People here in the Midwest understand that we prepare for winter. You know, you get your car ready, you get your furnace prepared, you get your winter outfits all set up. And so the idea of the precautionary principle is that we, in the face of scientific uncertainty and the likelihood of harm, we take action to prevent that harm. So in contrast, risk assessment, we wait and we measure and we manage and we wait for absolute proof before we take that activity, before we take that action that will block that activity or redirect it or choose a different one.
Yeah. This is, it seems to me, the problem here is that it's a very dramatically different mindset. It's a way of a very different way of thinking than has predominated before. And it, for example, it takes the approach that says if someone is thinking about doing something, that it's somehow incumbent on the government or interested groups to prove that there's harm attached to that. This, what this says is that it's actually incumbent on the person or entity that's thinking about taking this action to prove that it's safe. This is a very, very different way of approaching the environment.
I would be careful about saying that we prove it's safe. Almost nothing is safe. I could kill someone with salt, for instance.
No.
But what we want to know is that your activity in the world is not going to cause harm. It's like putting a teenager behind the wheel. We want them to be responsible for their actions in the world. And so it's... In some ways, I think the 16-year-old rule. Parents hold the 16-year-old accountable for their messes. They hold them responsible for the actions in the world. And we actually don't want to have the public, government, or an individual when they go to court suing over their toxic chemical, not to have the information that they need. So, for instance, the Europeans have adopted the precautionary principle. It's written into the Europeans' constitution that set up the European Union as one of their guiding ideas. And in the European Union now, they're putting the precautionary principle forward by, for instance, making chemical companies test their chemicals. If you haven't even done the tests yourself, why should I be responsible for proving harm if I can't get that information in the first place? So in the United States, if I go into court and you haven't tested your chemical, I am still obligated to demonstrate that your chemical could cause harm and that it caused my harm. So with precautionary principle, we reverse the burden of proof and make you take responsibility for at least doing the testing and making sure that it doesn't cause undue harm.
Why, I wonder, is it that when we talk about in trying to protect the quality of the environment and adopting a kind of a green stance, it always seems to come down to economics. And the argument is, some people in the argument they make is, well, you know, if we take a certain action, it's bad for the economy, that it will be bad for people who are trying to provide some kind of service or bad for industry. And eventually what that means is that whatever we do comes out of the pockets of consumers. And I guess I wonder why it is that it seems so difficult to make the argument that you can have a strong, healthy, thriving, green economy, that it doesn't, that doesn't necessarily have to be a negative.
Of course not. And one of the things that we found with environmental laws is that often the first thing that goes into international trade are those environmental technologies. So catalytic converters were the very first technology that was exported to Russia, and it was completely based on the Clean Air Act. So green laws have actually benefited trade. But I think the reason that we do that is in large part because of who's going to pay. We have decided that private people, individuals, will pay for health care. In Europe, where you have single payer or you have some kind of public option, government's paying for environmental and health problems. So if you get a cancer or you have a child with a birth defect from a toxic chemical, government's going to have to pay for that. They're much more interested then in regulating those chemicals because they're going to pay for the outcome. They're going to have to pay for your asthma if air pollution is causing you some kind of respiratory distress. So in the United States, we have a very different system. And because the individual both has to pay for their own health care and their own health insurance, and we have a very different kind of standard around environmental health issues. But I also want to make the point that environmental law is economic law. And so it's very difficult for us to think about it in a different way. Now, what is law? Don't be scared about using the word law. A lot of people will be put off by that and say, well, I don't know anything about it. I have to get a lawyer. But law is simply the set of rules that a community agrees to be bound by. And they become almost invisible. The fact that environmental law is economic law, that we make all of our decisions based on things like cost-benefit analysis and risk assessment. Does it have to be that way? And I think that the beauty of the precautionary principle is that it's helped to open the door to imagine an entirely different way of making environmental decisions that I think is pretty exciting.
Hmm. Let me just very quickly again introduce our guest, Carolyn Raffensperger. She is Executive Director of the Science and Environmental Health Network based in Ames, Iowa. She's an environmental lawyer. She works in the area of law and policy necessary for protection of public health and the environment. She's here visiting in Champaign-Urbana as the guest of the Prairie Rivers Network. She's the featured speaker for their annual dinner. That's tonight. And questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Well, you're an environmental lawyer, so I know that you're interested in environmental law and also that you would like to maybe try to talk a little bit about how our approach to environmental law maybe might change or you think should change.
I would love to. And, you know, talking about this in Illinois is such a pleasure. You know, there are other bodies of law than economic law, and we have firmly anchored environmental law in this free market analysis and legal system. But we have, for instance, a body of law that govern rights. And Illinois put into its constitution some years ago in the 1970s that an individual has a right to a clean and healthy environment. But we still think about that in economic terms, and we have not adjudicated that. We haven't made decisions about that right in such a way that would give that right the same kind of force that your right to practice your religion, your right to free speech has, that it's an inalienable right, that it is a right that is just part of being human. So we have not thought about environmental law as a matter of rights, that my right to a clean and healthy environment is as inalienable, as clear, as enforceable as my right to practice my religion. So other things that we understand may benefit the economy. Slavery is great for the economy. Child labor is great for the economy, but we don't do it. And we don't do it because we understand that it's wrong. And why we think that it's okay to pollute a child's air supply and that it's okay to do a cost-benefit analysis on their asthma or on their birth defect or on your mother's cancer. Why is that okay? Why is that still governed by economics rather than the same body of law, rights, that we govern other things like slavery or child labor? Seems to me that we can shift over and begin to think about environmental law as a matter of rights. So let's start with the idea that the individual would have an inalienable right to a clean and healthy environment. You would have that right to be born healthy, to be or at least as healthy as genetics and the rest allowed. But you'd be, what we know now is that you are born full of toxic chemicals before you ever enter the world, which means your mother was exposed, it crossed the placenta, and is now in that newborn baby. So imagine living in a world where we start out with healthy children, where we give them that inalienable right. So we create a legal structure that grants those rights. And then what if we decided to extend that right to future generations? And we said, this generation will take the responsibility seriously to pass on a world that is healthy, that is beautiful, that is full of all of our fellow species and other beings, that we'll have pollinators in the world, that we will have a clean Middle Fork river, that we will have all of those things that we will turn over in as good a condition as we possibly can to future generations. Mm-hmm. What if we decided to do that? What would our laws look like then?
Yeah. I guess I continued, though, thinking that having taken the cost-benefit analysis approach for such a long time, that I don't know how it is that we even get people starting, and particularly people, and not just people, but I mean people who make and enforce policy, to start thinking differently.
We'll need a transition plan. And I think that we'll need to start thinking about what the agencies do. You know, we have a huge infrastructure now that carries out all sorts of regulatory activities. And when I was here in Illinois, the Clean Air Act regulations were actually passed and for Illinois were written and put into place here in Illinois. So many of the Clean Water Act permits are evaluated here. But what if we decided that the institutions and the tasks are not the ones that we actually need? So the precautionary principle, you know, the simple algorithm of telling us to take preventive action in the face of scientific uncertainty doesn't really tell you what to do. And initially when we began our work on the precautionary principle, people thought we were going to ban everything and stop all progress and go back to horse and buggy days and, the horse and buggy days of my Amish great-grandfathers. But that's not the case. So we need to look for alternatives. If we have an activity that we think is necessary or some kind of product that we believe is useful, then we can look for the best alternatives. Companies have been doing this. Dell and Samsung, to name a couple of corporations, decided that using toxic chemicals in their computers and electronics was not a good idea. Wasn't a good idea for a lot of reasons. And so they looked for the best alternative and replaced it. What if we actually had agencies that looked for the best alternative to toxic chemicals or other harmful technologies and required corporations and industries to use the best alternative? We have nothing like that in place now. Reversing the burden of proof, simply requiring manufacturers and industry to test their products and to provide that information. What if we had a legal guardian for future generations who evaluated activities or legislation and regulations for their impact on future generations? So there are all sorts of things that we could do that would be completely new and innovative, that would not just be retrofitting, the old cost-benefit analysis, but would be doing new and things that would allow us to move forward in the world.
I have some callers here. We'll bring them into the conversation, starting with someone in Belgium. Line 4, hello.
Hello, and good morning to you all. Mm-hmm. I don't want this to get off onto the wrong side of it, but because I am definitely for the improvement of Mother Nature in every way, but we have to also consider the aspects that even the best things we do and our best intentions may have adverse consequences to us. And take the example of the Clean Water Act. We've cleaning up the waters more and more, but that adds to more biodiversity around, and this extra biodiversity might not come into exactly what we want to be. And I'll give you an example. Now that the streams and rivers are cleaning up more and more, we see lots more black fly down here in central Illinois. Black fly we haven't had for a long time. Black fly is very unpleasant. They stop golf games and little league games and everything in the central part of the state because they're just so irritating. We'd like to improve our world, but we have to remember everything we do, whether it's good or bad, is going to have an effect. Thank you very much.
That's a really interesting comment. And what it seems to me is that we need to have principles for evaluating our actions in the world. And an organization called the Natural Step has given us some guidance on that. And so we know that for instance, all waste should be food for something else. It's a design principle. So if I actually have waste from, say, food production, can that be composted? Can it be food for livestock, et cetera? So all waste must be food for something else. We can't take out from minerals and things from the earth faster than the earth can regenerate, another principle of the Natural Step. And we can't put things back into the earth faster than it can incorporate it in a normal way. And we have to attend to biodiversity. Seems to me that the biggest problem is that we've been thinking economically and not ecologically. So yeah, there will be changes in the environment. Whether they are adverse is a matter of judgment. And whether it interferes with Little League systems, it might actually benefit birds and increase the bird population that eats insects. So we really need to begin thinking ecologically rather than economically.
All right, let's talk with someone in Champaign County. Line one, hello.
Hi, I don't want to digress too much either, but I was just struck by the idea that, you know, one talks about the economy and economic analysis in a very, you know, reductionist way. And to say that slavery and child labor is good for the economy is, well, it's good for a feudal economy, but if you take a longer view of things, you know, you're missing the development potential of, you know, education till college level for children, for one, and you're also but that's just a bit of an aside, but a lot of times economics is invoked without too much scrutiny, it seems to me. But and one of the things that you can...
By the way, I love your point about not thinking reductionistically about economics. That's a lovely idea that I will take with me.
We're good. I wanted you to talk about atrazine, and atrazine is banned in the EU, I believe, and many other places in the world. It's used widespread here, and I guess it could be used as another example of how you take a longer-term view of the economy. What kind of health burden is this on our workers in rural areas to have bladder cancer, whatever else is involved in atrazine? So it isn't as simple as just saying that you know, that of course the unintended consequences arguments, but to just accept some kind of free market fundamentalism that, you know, things will work out because the market will decide that atrazine is bad is obviously, it hasn't worked. So I'll just sign off and let you react. Thank you very much.
Well, atrazine is a really interesting problem, and it's been studied quite a bit. And, you know, I followed some of the research by people like Tyrone Hayes and University of California in Berkeley and the effects of atrazine on frogs. And I would say that as go the frogs, so go humans. And I think we'll just let your comments stand. I think you've made a great job talking about the problems of economics and chemicals like atrazine.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Carolyn Raffensperger. She's the executive director of the Science and Environmental Health Network in Ames, Iowa. She's an environmental lawyer, works on changing law and policy, moving it in the direction of protecting public health and the environment. She's the co-editor of the book Precautionary Tools for Reshaping Environmental Policy, and also the book Protecting Public Health and the Environment, Implementing the Precautionary Principle. So those are things, if you're kind of interested in reading more about Precautionary Principle, you can look at that. Also, if you're interested in finding out more about her organization, you can go to their website, the Science and Environmental Health Network, and read there about things like the precautionary principle and some of her other ideas about the environment. She is has a history of working in an environmental area here in the state of Illinois. She was director of the Illinois chapter of the Sierra Club and also was president of the board of directors of the Illinois Environmental Council. And she's here visiting in our area for the annual dinner of the Prairie Rivers Network. She's their featured speaker, and that's tonight. So questions here are welcome to 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. I'm just wondering what you think. Sometimes I think that one of the problems that we have here and one reason that it's difficult sometimes, I think, to get people to think in the way that you suggest is that we're not very good at thinking about the public good. It just doesn't seem to be a fundamental part of the way that we think. And I think too much when it comes to environmental issues, we keep bumping up against, you know, the tragedy of the commons, and that somehow the idea that resources are that resources belong to everyone and that everyone has a stake in environmental quality, somehow that seems to be a difficult idea for us.
Oh, I think it's probably easier in Champaign-Urbana because of the work of amazing environmentalists here. What a story of the commons you have with Allerton Park and so many others. But I want to step back and talk a little bit about the commons. The woman who just won the Nobel Prize, Eleanor Ostrom, won it because she discussed the commons. And I just wrote a paper on the law of the commons that I think is the paper of record now on the law of the commons, and looked at 10 basic legal ideas that we have currently in American law that govern the commons, how, you know, the things that we share. So I'll just name some things that we do share, and people will understand completely about the commons. So, for instance, wildlife in Illinois. If you're going to go deer hunting or duck hunting, you have to get a license from the state of Illinois to do that, hunting or fishing. That's because wildlife does belong to all of the people of Illinois. And so the state is the trustee, not the owner, the trustee of the common wealth and the common health for this generation and for future generations. And so we have all sorts of legal principles for taking care of things like wildlife or state parks or national parks for that matter. And it seems to me that there's some basic legal principles that we need to follow. And I'll just throw out one that helps us think economically and in terms of future generations. What if we, for instance, did an audit? Well, I'm going to give you two. The first one isn't economic, but what if we did an audit of the commons? What if people in Champaign-Urbana actually did an inventory of everything that is part of the commons, the water, the air, the parks, and came up with a plan to turn that over in better shape to future generations? Then we got it. The history of creating commons and shared spaces and shared things in Illinois is really quite remarkable. And the heroes in Champaign-Urbana, from Sandy and Bob Bales and Pat and Bruce Hannon, and these wonderful people who made sure that these places were saved in perpetuity for future generations, is a remarkable story. So one of the things that I think we could do in terms of evaluating our budget, another principle of the commons, what if we said we will not leave a debt to future generations without a corresponding asset? Sure, let's post bonds for more parks or for cleaning up water, but not for radioactive waste facilities. We need to pay for our messes as we go. But a basic principle of the commons, so that we don't have a tragedy of the commons. It's when I think of making messes and leaving them to future generations and expecting them to pay for them, that's really colonialism. You know, we're taking over that time, that future of future generations. So no debt to future generations without a corresponding asset, I think, is a wonderful idea. And I, you know, my sense is that people here have understood the commons. They've understood how to share. They've understood how we need to pass it on to future generations in ways that are really landmark studies. And those stories should be told.
Let's talk with somebody in Chicago. They are the next in line on our line four. Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
Well, your last caller made a very good point. However, I think what's a little missing, and Al Gore sort of alludes to it, although not firmly enough, is the whole class issue. The last caller said, well, this isn't working. Well, for who? The current system's working fine for rich people. Their stocks in oil companies have done well. Their stocks in coal companies do very well. And to talk about law is an interpreted thing. When you look at the way the Supreme Court interprets laws, well, the Supreme Court currently can take what would be clear to everybody, that ExxonMobil should have been fined mightily for the Exxon Valdez. And the thing gets to the Supreme Court, and it's basically nothing. It's basically a fine that amounts to far less than their operating costs for having done that. So just having laws isn't going to do it. You have to kind of think about who's interpreting the laws and to whose benefit, and who really cares about whether the environment's good or not. I mean, rich people, they can just move to another part of the world. They can live in a gated community. They can buy the most expensive organic food from Whole Foods, while the rest of the people in the country suffer with the consequences of their interfering with every common sense law that you might have written.
I completely agree, and thank you for your voice and your witness on behalf of people who have suffered really environmental travesties. There's a branch of the environmental movement called environmental justice, which says that poor people and people of color have suffered disproportionately from environmental problems. So we don't put our solid waste facilities in rich communities. We put them in poor communities. And yes, we have done terrible, terrible things to poor people. And it is a class issue. And we do have laws that guarantee the rich get richer. And the interesting thing about environmental toxics is that no gated community can keep the air clean even in the gated community. And the toxic chemicals that are airborne and waterborne contaminate the rich just as much as they do the poor. Yes, rich people can buy their organic food, and yes, they can get a water purifier and all of that. And one of the things that's interesting is that we find some environmentally related diseases in a higher proportion in some wealthy communities. There's some wealthier communities that have higher breast cancer rates, for instance, and it may be related to lifestyle, including things like dry cleaning. Or those, the information is not clear. We don't understand why. We do know that poverty exacerbates environmental health problems. So, if you have a poor child who has an iron deficient diet and they're in the presence of lead, first of all, lead blocks the uptake of iron. And if you've got a child with too much lead, poverty and the social stressors will increase them and magnify the effects. We see that across the board. And so justice seems to me to be essential. The precautionary principle is interesting because it's not a rule that just relies on science and what we know and what we don't know. It is at its heart an ethical rule. And so that sense of justice, that sense that that poverty is an environmental issue, it's an environmental matter, that the issues around future generations is a matter of justice as well. The precautionary principle stands for that ethical idea that we will act justly towards all of our fellow beings.
All right. And to someone here on a cell phone in Salem, this is our line one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I appreciate all the work you're doing. I had a question if you've done any research on pharmaceuticals and chemicals from farming, agriculture, in the water, in the air, on the high number of children that are born with autism, and there's a Rett syndrome where the muscles are weak, that and I guess Alzheimer's with the elderly. But I live in a farming community, and I know that I believe they banned atrazine at one time, and they allowed it again because the farmers say they can't get any of the weed knocked down without it. There's nothing else to take its place. And I just don't know how you're going to fight Monsanto and all of these other huge community or huge corporations. But carry on, and you're doing a good job. I'd be interested in your comments about the pharmaceuticals and the water and everything.
Okay.
Well, we have what goes into us comes out of us. The USGS, the U.S. Geological Survey, has done water surveys across the country and shown that pharmaceuticals are present in the water. Things like caffeine, skincare products like sunscreens are washed off and go into the water. And then add to that the agricultural chemicals that we cover our landscape with, urban and rural. is pretty amazing. I would direct you to a couple of studies. One is a study that my organization co-released with Greater Boston Physicians for Social Responsibility. We did a report on aging and the environment, and a great deal of work has been done on children and environmental issues. So, for instance, we know that in certain parts of the United States, babies that are conceived in the spring have more birth defects, and it seems to be associated with agricultural chemicals. We know that in some places of the Midwest as well, more rural women go to infertility clinics because of reproductive disorders. But what we know about some of these chemicals is that some of them are neurotoxicants, and so we have neurodevelopmental problems, things like autism. Autism is not clearly understood in terms of its environmental links. We do know that the rate of autism has gone up significantly. The rates in places like California have gone up so many fold over a very short period of time. But what's also interesting is that we see neurodegenerative problems associated with these environmental toxicants. And so the report that we just did on environmental threats to healthy aging looked at both Parkinson's and Alzheimer's. And it appears that there are a number of environmental factors that play into both. We know that pesticides has a pretty strong link to Parkinson's, and it appears that some of these chemicals, which we know are neurotoxicants, can also impact Alzheimer's. That report can be found on agehealthyoneword.org, and that report was actually released on the Today Show. Another website that I would invite you to look at is the website, the Collaborative on Health and the Environment, and I don't know what the actual website addresses, but if you look for the Collaborative on Health and the Environment, they have a chart that goes through many different environmental factors, whether it's lead or whether it's atrazine or various pesticides, and examines what we know about their links to various diseases. And the chart, which was in part done by our scientist, the physician Ted Shetler, it tells you how strong the evidence is. So some things we have really, really good information about, and some things we, you know, the evidence isn't very strong, and it will give you all of that information. So, you know, it seems to me that if we are going to be increasingly filling our world with toxic chemicals, and children are born where they are set back before they ever begin, and then when we are treating our elders with such cavalier disregard, and if Alzheimer's is actually delayable or in some cases preventable, shouldn't we do that as a matter of both the human right, but even as a matter of economics, that it's a lot more expensive to families and to our states to take care of people who have are no longer able to function and to remember even who their spouses are, much less how to, you know, get dressed and turn off the stove.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Carolyn Raffensperger. She's the executive director of the Science and Environmental Health Network based in Ames, Iowa. She's an environmental attorney, and she's here in the area to give a talk. She is the featured speaker at the annual dinner of the Prairie Rivers Network. Questions welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. You know, I think that it's true that surveys have shown that a lot of people are concerned about the environment, or at least I suppose if you just ask that, if you just ask it that way, you ask people, well, you know, are you concerned about the environment? I expect probably a lot of people would say yes. Now, though, then if you maybe try to tease out, well, what is the nature of their concern, or are they doing anything in their lives? Say if they say yes, and then you say, okay, what in your life are you doing to try to address that concern, then I really wonder what, you know, what people are doing, and in fact whether the fact that people say they're concerned about the environment gets translated into any kind of action that they take in their daily lives.
You know, I think people are remarkable, and I have come from a farm in North Dakota, and most of my neighbors, I don't know if they even made it through high school. And I found them smart about this kind of thing. And so they were doing things that made sense for them and in their life. I think every single parent has awakened in the morning and said, how do I keep my child safe? And they will do everything possible, everything that they can possibly afford to keep that child healthy. And they will, even if they cannot afford anything and they're getting food out of the food pantry, they're doing their best to give their kid organic fruits and vegetables if they can possibly do it because they love that baby. And I think parents are a front line of defense on environmental issues. But it seems to me that the biggest issue is addressed by the sense of, it shows up in their sense of powerlessness. You know, the callers that we've had today, that we can't stop atrazine even though we know so much about it. And how do we think about the livelihood of farmers? And how do we work in such a way that we produce food for the population? But that sense of powerlessness, that we can't change those water permits very easily or very quickly so that we protect our waterways, that we can't get the nitrates out of the water and still face problems. In my town or in the state that I live in right now in Iowa, Des Moines has the highest nitrate level from nitrogen pollution of any state. We have the biggest water treatment facility to get it out of the water. You know, that's a problem. And I think that people feel powerless in the face of this big juggernaut of institutions, laws, that things seem to be the way they are. I have heard that the way that you frame it, if you say, you know, 90% of the people on your block are actually reducing their energy. They've turned their thermostat down. People are walking more because they don't want to add the greenhouse gases. You know, people are doing amazing things. We just don't talk about it. And when people come to my house, you know, they might not notice that I don't have paper towels. They might not notice that I don't have garbage pickup. Not everybody's going to do that. But I know so many people that have made small changes in their daily life and are doing the best they can because they love their children and because they love their neighbor's child.
Yeah. I think I don't mean to be overly pessimistic, but I guess one of the things I also feel that is kind of an issue is that in many respects, I think our economy has done a very good job at keeping hidden from us the environmental costs of the way that we live.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
Because we really don't, we certainly don't pay for them up front. We may eventually have to pay for them. And I think that there are some people who make the argument that that's, that's backwards, you know, and that they ought to be very evident to us up front. But they're not.
I think that they're becoming more evident. Mm-hmm. And I think that the public discussion on global warming and climate chaos, I think, is bringing some of these ideas to the fore. And I want to speak specifically to students and to others who are listening and who want to do something around the environment, maybe even do this as a livelihood, get a job in the environmental movement. And I so often hear from students that it's hopeless. There's nothing that we can do. It's all over. And I say to you, it's worthy work. Is there hope? I'm not optimistic in the, you know, do I think everything's going to turn out all right? I subscribe to what Vaclav Havel defines as hope, and that is the deep orientation of the soul towards what is right. It's a compass orientation that I am going to do for future generations, for the poor. I am going to be on the side of nature no matter what. I am going to judge my actions by their effect on those beings. And it seems to me that because we don't know whether it's going to be successful, it is worth everything that we've got. It is worthy work. And, you know, if it was not worthy work, why go do something else? Go do something that was, you know, make a lot of money. But it is worthy work. And it requires all of us to put everything we've got into the cause. And your skills are going to be different than mine. And they are valued and they are treasured. And I've just gotten these stories in the last while of these amazing environmentalists and conservationists here in Champaign-Urbana. And but for work that was done 50 years ago, we would not have the assets that we've got here in Champaign-Urbana and in Illinois. And so we can take our turn now and step up to the plate. It's worthy work.
Well, let's talk with somebody else. Effingham, line four. Hello.
I'm remembering the Industrial Revolution and the English and the coal and the pollution and the working class created and where they lived. The early bourgeoisie lived near or at the places where they made their money, and the pollution was so bad that they moved out. But the lower working classes had to remain there. And this was going on right up into the 1950s, if I read it properly. And nowadays, the super rich move to islands and away from the horrible things that they do. And my observation of the environment as an outhouse for human defecation of a beautiful scene remains. Thank you.
We are one of the few species that follows its own nest.
Can I just, we have a few minutes left here, and I guess one of the things I was a little bit curious about was how it is that you got involved in doing environmental work, because I don't think that that's what you started out doing.
No, I started out as an archaeologist, and I had a wonderful career as an archaeologist. You know, there are a lot of places to tell that story and ways to tell that story, and I'm sometimes think that my origin myth, my origin story, begins with my father, who was surgeon in chief at Children's Memorial Hospital, but even before that was a pediatric surgeon at Cook County Hospital in Chicago. And my dad came home once and said that the birth defects that he saw and that were increasing over the course of his career were actually caused by pollution. And I said, "Well, Dad, you have to do something about it." He said, "I can't, because I can't prove it." And when he faced these babies that were born through no fault of their own with terrible things that would change their lives forever. And, you know, the birth defects that I saw going to the hospital with them were horrific. And I don't know if anyone is listening to me on the radio now, but may have had a family member that my father operated on. And I wanted to do something about that. If babies were actually being caused to suffer in this way, because of pollution, it seemed to me we had to do something about it. And then I think the second big story was I was working as an archaeologist in the Four Corners area of the desert Southwest, and Ronald Reagan became president, and he appointed James Watt, and James Watt decided to put radioactive waste near Capitol Reef. And I was a young Christian Midwesterner, and I didn't have any idea of how to stop that, but I decided to do everything I could. And so began my career as an environmentalist. I came back from Colorado, Southwest Colorado, where I was working on the Dolores Dam Project. And I went to work for the Sierra Club, and I figured out the things that the Sierra Club had known and so many other people about how to work for the public good. And I dedicated my life to that.
So are you optimistic about that? You're giving us a very positive message in the sense that you believe that people are capable of change, capable of doing the right thing, capable of a future orientation that particularly thinks about not just what's going on now and how they're living now, but what kind of place their children and grandchildren are going to have to live in. So you're certainly allowing for the fact that that potential is there.
It has to be. David Brower said pessimism is a luxury that we can't afford. And as I said, I'm not optimistic in the sense that I think everything's going to turn out okay. You know, the trend lines are not going in good directions. And it doesn't matter whether it's the increase in learning disabilities or the increase in Alzheimer's or, you know, what we see in the population is increases in many, many chronic diseases that are going to lead to health problems that are, you know, pretty catastrophic for the system. I think that what we see with climate change, what we see with the loss of biodiversity and the collapse of honeybees, things like that. But I return to this deep orientation of the soul and that it's worthy work. One of the ways that I know about callings is that I can't do anything else. I have to do this. This is, I think, why I was put on the earth. And, you know, the sense of calling I have it manifests itself in, I wake up every single day going, we're in deep trouble. I've got an idea. And I think that that's what keeps me going.
Real quick, we'll try to get one more caller. Bloomington, Illinois, line 4. Hello.
Yeah, I usually listen to the program, and I just turned in. I'm terribly sorry to have missed such a wonderful program. But I did want to say thank you. And I don't know if you've talked about a plant-based diet, but I do follow a plant-based diet, which in my understanding is environmentally good. And I have a farm which I'm going organic with. And my most of my friends recycle, as well as myself. So I find all that very encouraging. And thank you for your work.
Okay. Thank you for your work. Thank you for doing the best you know and standing for what's right. Thank you so much.
Well, we are going to have to stop here just because we've come to the end of the time. Our guest, Carolyn Raffensperger, is Executive Director of the Science and Environmental Health Network based in Ames, Iowa. They do have a website, and there's a lot of information on the subject that we've been talking about. So one thing that you might do is, if you have internet access, go to www.sehn. So that's the initials, Science Environmental Health Network, SEHN.org. And you can find out more about her and about the precautionary principle and other sorts of things. She's here visiting in Champaign-Urbana. She's going to be the featured speaker for the annual dinner of the Prairie Rivers Network. And that is taking place tonight. Well, thanks very much for being here.
My pleasure. And I want to thank all of the people in this area for the environmental things that you have pioneered. Thank you so much.